The keeper was barrel-shaped, with oily skin, enhanced by a sheen of terrified sweat. His lips pulled back in a snarl of defiance, and he kept lashing out with serpent strikes of his force whip. The Wookiees growled, trying to come close enough to rip him apart with their claws. Chewbacca let out his own roar of challenge. Some of the Wookiees glanced up at the rescue force, but other hairy giants were so transfixed by their chance to get the keeper that they paid no heed. "Drop your weapon," the commando team leader said to the keeper. All the blaster rifles were directed toward him. It amused Chewbacca to see the cruel man glance at the New Republic force with an expression of relief. The Wookiees continued to snarl. They looked worse now than they had appeared only months earlier. No doubt without the protection of Admiral Dalla's fleet, the keeper had forced the slaves to work even harder to arrange other defenses for Maw installation. "Drop your weapon," I said, the strike team commander insisted. The keeper flicked his force whip once more, driving the Wookiee mob back. Chewbacca saw the three largest males in front, their fur streaked and patchy, burned from lashes of the whip, and shiny with wax-like welts from old scars. The oldest gray-furred Wookiee, whom Chewbacca remembered as Nauroon, crouched by the edge of the shuttle, hiding under the sharp panels of the ship's upfolded wings. The old Wookiee's bones seemed twisted and crushed from years of labor, but the anger in his eyes was brighter than a star. The keeper raised his force whip, stared at the Wookiees, then at Page's commandos. The human team leader fired a warning shot, which spanged off the chamber walls. The keeper raised his other hand in surrender, then let the handle of his force whip fall to the ground. It clinked on the smooth deck plate. "All right now, back away," the team leader said. Chewbacca offered his own words in the Wookiee language. The astonished prisoners stood tense for a moment. The keeper looked ready to collapse in terror when suddenly old Nauroon dived to the floor, lunging with a hairy paw to snatch the handle of the whip. He fumbled the activation switches. The keeper shrieked and backed against the wall, looking for someplace to hide. Chewbacca yowled for the Wookiees to stop, but they didn't hear him as they all surged forward, claws extended, ready to shred the keeper into bloody pieces. Nauroon sprang upon the man's barrel-like form. Though he was misshapen and old, the hunched Wookiee gripped the force whip like a club and tackled the keeper to the floor. The burly man screamed and flailed. The other Wookiees fell upon him. Nauroon jammed the handle of the force whip into the keeper's face and switched on the weapon at full power. The lance of lashing energy drilled into the keeper's head, skirling fireworks inside his brain pan. Sparks came out of his eye sockets until the keeper's skull shattered, showering the hysterical Wookiee prisoners with gore. Silence thundered down upon the chamber. Chewbacca walked carefully forward as the surviving Wookiees withered. Without any stamina or fury, they backed away from the corpse of their tormentor. Old Nauroon stood again and stared blankly down at the force whip in his hand. He let it drop. It struck the floor with a hollow sound, and Nauroon crumpled beside it. His body shuddered, and he made hollow sounds as he wept. Tal Sivran tried to find a comfortable place to sit back and relax in the pilot compartment of the Death Star, but the prototype had not been designed for niceties. Racks of equipment stood surrounded by bare wires and clumsy welds. Girders and reinforced framework blocked his view of most of the embattled installation, but he could see that the rebel forces had overrun the facility. At the outer perimeter of the clustered planetoids, the tangled cooling towers and radiation vanes of the power reactor suddenly glowed bright and began to collapse. Werman's gruff voice came over the radio. "Director Sivran, our explosives have destroyed the coolant system. The power reactor will soon go supercritical. I don't think the attackers can stop it. Maw installation is doomed." "Very well, Werman," Sivran said, dismayed at the loss of capital equipment. But what could he do, after all? His Imperial Guardians had deserted him. He and his division leaders had done quite a creditable job of putting up a fight. Without any military help, they couldn't be expected to succeed against a well-armed strike force, could they? Besides, they were following established procedure. No one could fault them for that. Sivran looked at the stormtrooper captain and at the other three division leaders. The rest of the Maw scientists and stormtrooper contingents had taken refuge inside the prototype's supply and control room. "I have not had a chance to read the complete technical readouts of this battle station prototype." Tal Sivran looked around. "Does anyone know how to fly this vessel?" Galanda looked at Doxson, who in turn looked at Yem. The stormtrooper captain said, I have had some experience flying attack vehicles, sir. Perhaps I can interpret the controls. Good, Captain, Tal Sivran said. He stood up from his command chair. Do you need to sit here? No need, sir. I can handle it from the pilot station. The captain went over to a bolted-together row of controls. They must have detected Wurman's explosions, Doxson said, watching the rebel attack ships clustered around the reactor planetoid. Two more shuttles descended as teams were deployed down to the power station. The combined rebel firepower would block all rescue attempts. Now, how are we supposed to get Wurman? Sivran said. Yem began to flip through the emergency procedures manual again. I don't think we addressed that contingency either. Tal Sivran's head tails thrashed in extreme annoyance. That's not very good, is it? He scowled, trying to figure out how he could adapt on the spot. Twi'leks were good at adapting. Sivran had managed to adapt when he left his home planet of Ryloth. He had adapted when Moff Tarkin had assigned him as director of the think tank. Now he would adapt his plans again to make the best of a situation that was growing worse by the minute. All right, so there's no time to rescue Wurman. Change of plans. Our duty is to the Empire. We must take this Death Star prototype and make a rapid retreat. Wurman himself had seen the rebel strike teams coming down to retake the reactor planetoid, and he contacted Tal Sivran again with a more frantic tenor in his voice. Director, what can I do to assist you? How are you planning to rescue us? Tal Sivran opened the channel and said in his gravest, most sincere voice, Wurman, I just want you to know how much I admire and respect you for your years of service. I regret that your retirement cannot be as long and as happy as I had hoped it would be. Once again, accept my appreciation. Thank you. He signed off, then turned to the stormtrooper captain. We need to get out of here now. When the heaviest fighting began to die away, Kwai-Zook settled down to the installation with Wedge Antilles. Kwai saw the planetoids growing larger as they approached. She had spent most of her life down there, but she remembered little of it. Other than the destruction of the first corvette, the New Republic fleet had suffered minimal losses. The Maw scientists had put up even less resistance than Wedge had feared. Kwai looked forward now to going through her old labs, eager to find her own files in hopes of answering some of her questions, but afraid to learn the answers. Wedge reached over to hold her hand. It'll be fine. You'll be a great help. Wait and see. She looked longingly at him with her large eyes. I'll do my best. But something caught her attention, and she pointed quickly. Look, Wedge, we've got to stop it. The Death Star prototype rose away from Maw installation under its own power, glistening in the reflected light of the gas cloud. According to my own records, Maw installation had a fully functional prototype, Kwai said. If they take that Death Star into New Republic space... Before she could complete her sentence, the gigantic sphere of the Death Star shot away toward the edge of the black hole cluster and vanished into the masking clouds of super-hot gas. 9. Terpfen stood in the looming shadow of the great temple as Yavin's early daylight increased, warming the jungles until mists rose in the air. Paralyzed with fear in front of the towering ancient ziggurat, Terpfen swiveled his circular eyes to look back to the landing area where his stolen B-wing fighter rested, humming and ticking as it cooled among the cropped weeds. He saw discolored smears on its hull from where the pursuing X-wing fighters on Coruscant had scored direct hits. Looking up, he spotted several of the Jedi candidates, tiny figures atop the temple. As the jungle moon orbited around the gas giant, the configuration of the system set up an unusual phenomenon that had filled the rebels with wonder when they first established the small moon as a secret base. Bright sunlight streaming through the upper layers of the Yavin primary refracted in many different colors, then struck the moon's atmosphere, filtered through the rising mist to let loose a shower of rainbows that lasted only minutes with each dawn. The Jedi trainees, gathered to watch the rainbow storm high above, had seen his ship land. They were coming. In a slick fighter jumpsuit that bore no insignia, Terpfen felt his heart pounding, his mind whirling. Confessing his traitorous acts frightened him the most, but Terpfen had to face it. He tried to rehearse his words, but decided that it would not help. There was no good way to share the terrible news. He felt dizzy, ready to faint, and grasped the cool, moss-covered blocks of the temple with one flippered hand. He feared that Kirita had somehow found him again, that Fergin was sinking his clutches into the organic components that had been substituted for parts of Turpin's brain. No, it was his mind now. He had not felt the tug from his imperial controllers for over a day now. He'd forgotten what it was like to think his own thoughts, and he had tested the new freedom with growing wonder. He fantasized about overthrowing the Empire, about throttling bug-eyed Ambassador Fergin. And during these thoughts, no shadowy presence squashed his mind. He felt so free. He realized the faintness was just his numbing fright. The feeling passed, and Turpin stood straight again as he heard footsteps approach. The first to emerge into the bright daylight was Minister of State Leia Organa Solo herself. She must have run to the turbo lift, expecting that the B-wing fighter carried some emergency message from Coruscant. Her hair looked mussed and windblown, and shadows haunted her eyes. Her face wore a concerned frown, as if something else already troubled her. Turpin felt the cold despair increase within him. She would be even more agonized after he told her that the Imperials knew the location of her son, Anakin. Leia stopped and looked gravely at him, sizing him up. Her brows drew together in thought, and then she said his name.
I know you. Turpin, right? Why have you come here?
Turpin knew that his battered, bulbous head and the lumpy mappings of scars made him recognizable even to humans. Behind Leia came several Jedi students Turpin did not recognize until he saw Ambassador Kilgall. The female Calamarian's large, round eyes seemed to bore into his soul.
Minister Organa Solo,
Turpin said in a quavering voice. Then he collapsed to his knees, partly in abject misery and partly because his legs refused to support him any longer.
Your son, Anakin, is in grave danger.
He hung his scarred head. Before she could fire off laser-sharp questions, Turpin confessed everything. Leia stared down at Turpin's scarred head and felt as if she were being strangled. Luke and Akbar's intricate security and secrecy about Anoth had been breached. The Empire knew where to find her baby son. Leia understood little about the defenses on the sheltered, hellish world. Now her servant and friend Winter was the only protection baby Anakin had.
Please, Minister Organa Solo, we must go to Anoth at once,
Turpin said. We must send them a message. Evacuate your child before an Imperial strike squad can reach him. While I was under Fergin's influence, I transmitted Anoth's coordinates to Kirita, but I did not keep a copy of them. I destroyed that information. You must take us there yourself. I will do whatever I can to help, but we must move quickly. Leia made ready to leap into action, ready to do anything necessary to save her son. But a paralyzing realization brought her up short.
I can't contact Anna. Even I don't know where the planet is.
Turpin stared at her, but she couldn't read expressions on his angular aquatic face. She continued,
it was kept secret from me, too. The only ones who knew were Winter, and she's on Anoth, and Akbar, who is now hiding on Calamari, and Luke, who's in a coma. I don't know how to get there.
She steadied herself, trying to recall how fast-thinking she had been in her younger days. On the first Death Star, she had taken charge during Han and Luke's ill-planned rescue. She had known what to do then. She had acted quickly and without hesitation. But now she had three children to care for, and her new priorities seemed to scramble her single-mindedness. Han had already departed to search for Kip Duran and the Sun Crusher. She'd been left here with the twins, supposedly to keep them safe. She couldn't just leave now. Ambassador Kilgall seemed to sense her thoughts.
You must go, Leia. Go save your son. Your twin children will be safe here. The Jedi students will protect them.
As if suddenly freed of something she hadn't known was binding her, Leia felt plans plunge into her conscious mind. Relaxing, she became cool and decisive.
All right, Turpin, you're coming with me. We'll go to Calamari as fast as we can. We'll find Akbar, and he can take us to Winter and Anakin.
She looked at the traitor with a complex mixture of anger and hope, pity and sorrow. He turned away.
No, what if the Imperials activate me again? What if I am forced to commit some new sabotage?
I'll keep my eyes peeled, she said in a hard voice, but I want you to come see Akbar. She thought of the Calamarian Admiral's misery, how he had gone to hide in the wilderness of his planet so others would not have to look at his shame. You're going to explain to him that he wasn't at fault in the vortex crash. Turpin worked his way back to his feet. He wobbled on his feet, but finally stood firm.
Minister Organa, Solo, he said.
His voice sounded as if he had swallowed something unpleasant.
I am sorry.
She shot a look at him, but she felt adrenaline pumping through her, a need to be on the move, to do anything possible. Hesitation could mean the loss of everything. Apologize when this is all over, she said. Right now, I need your help. 10. The Millennium Falcon emerged from hyperspace near the coordinates of the destroyed Corridon star system. Han Solo polarized the segmented viewport to look out at the rubble that had recently been a group of planets and a burning sun. Now he saw only a slash of still glowing gases, a sea of radiation from the supernova. The sheer destruction was on a scale greater even than when he had emerged from hyperspace to find Alderaan reduced to broken debris. Back before he had even met Leia, before he had thrown his lot in with the rebellion, and before he had believed in the Force. Corridon's exploded star had spewed stellar material in a thick band around the ecliptic, vast curtains of roiling gases that glowed and crackled with intense energy across the spectrum. A shock wave plowed through space where it would dissipate over thousands of years. Under his high-resolution scanners, Han spotted a few twisted cinders, burned out lumps of worlds that had been the outer planets in the system. Now they shone like embers in a dying fire. Lando Calrissian sat beside him, his mouth open in amazement.
Boy, that kid sure knows how to cause damage.
Han nodded. His throat felt dry and raw. It felt strange not to have Chewbacca in the co-pilot's seat. He hoped his Wookiee friend was having an easier time on his mission than Han was. The Falcon's sensor banks barely coped with the overloading energies that pulsed through the wreckage of the Corridon system. X-rays and gamma rays hammered against his shields, but Han saw no sign of Kip.
Han, what do you think you'll find with all this static? If you're real sharp and real lucky, you might detect an ion trace from the Sun Crusher's sublight engine, but in the middle of a supernova, you'll never pick up the track. Odds are...
Han cut him off with a raised hand.
Never quote me the odds. You know better than that.
Lando grinned.
Yeah, I know.